the bed and looked up and saw Derek's arm hanging over the side, blood running down under his shirt sleeve and across his hand and drip, drip, dripping off his fingers. He didn't want to touch a dead person, not even a dead person he liked. But this was what he had to do, and he was used to having to do all sorts of things he wished he didn't. That was what life was like. So he grabbed the edge of the bed and pulled himself up as fast as he could, trying not to feel the bad hurt in his back and in his kicked leg, because feeling it would make him stiff and slow. Derek was right there, eyes open, mouth open, blood wet, so sad, so scary, on top of the pictures of his folks that fell off the wall, still dead, off for always and ever to the bad place. Thomas grabbed the scissors sticking out of Derek, pulled them loose, telling himself it was okay because Derek couldn't feel anything now or ever. "You," the bad thing said. Thomas turned to see where the bad thing was, and where it was right behind him, all the way around the bed, coming at him. So he shoved the scissors at it, hard as he could, and the bad thing's face made a surprised look. The scissors went in the front of the bad thing's shoulder. The bad thing looked even more surprised. The blood came. Letting go of the scissors, Thomas said, "For Derek." Then he said, "For me." He wasn't sure what would happen, but he figured that making the blood come would hurt the bad thing and maybe make it dead, like it made Derek dead. Across the room, he saw where the window wasn't anymore and where part of the wall wasn't anymore, some smoke coming from the broken ends of things. He figured he was going to run over there and go through the hole, even if the night was out there on the other side. But he never figured on what did happen, because the bad thing acted like the scissors weren't even in it, like blood wasn't being let loose from it. And it grabbed him and lifted him up again. It slammed him into Derek's dresser, which was a lot more hurt than the wall, because the dresser was made with knobs and edges the wall didn't have. He heard something crack in him, heard something tear. But the funny thing was, he wasn't crying anymore and didn't want to cry anymore, like he'd used up all the tears in himself. The bad thing put its face close to Thomas's face, so their eyes were only a couple of inches apart. He didn't like looking in the bad thing's eyes. They were scary. They were blue, but it was like they were really dark, like under the blue was a lot of stuff as black as night out past the gone window. But the funny thing was, he wasn't as scared as he was a while ago, like he'd used up all his being scared, just like he'd used up his tears. He looked in the bad thing's eyes, and he saw all that big dark, bigger than the dark that came over the world each day when the sun went away, and he knew it was wanting to make him dead, going to make him dead, and that was okay. He was not so afraid of being made dead as he always thought he would be. It was still a bad place, death, and he wished he didn't have to go there. But he had a funny nice feeling about the bad place all of a sudden, a feeling that maybe it wouldn't be so lonely over there as he always figured it was, not even as lonely as it was on this side. He felt maybe someone was over there who loved him, someone who loved him more than even Julie loved him, even more than their dad used to love him, someone who was all bright, no dark at all, so bright that you could only look at him sideways. The bad thing held Thomas against the dresser with one hand, and with the other hand it pulled the scissors out of itself. Then it put the scissors in Thomas. This light started to fill up Thomas, this light that loved him, and he knew he was going away. He hoped, when he was all gone, Julie would know how brave he was right at the end, how he stopped crying and stopped being scared and fought back. And then all of a sudden he remembered he hadn't TV'd a warning to Bobby that the bad thing might be coming for them too, and he started to do that. The scissors went in again. Then all of a sudden he knew something even more important he had to do. He had to let Julie know that the bad place was not so bad after all, that there was a light over there that loved you, you could tell. She needed to know about it because, deep down, she really didn't believe it. She figured it was all dark and lonely, the way Thomas once figured it was. So she counted each clock tick and worried about all she had to do before her time ran out, all she had to learn and see and feel and get, all she had to do for Thomas and for Bobby, so they would be okay if something happened to her. And the scissors went in again. And she was happy with Bobby, but she was never going to be real happy until she knew she didn't have to be so angry about everything ending in a big dark. She was so nice, it was hard to figure she was angry inside, but she was. Thomas only figured it out now, as the light was filling him up, figured out how terrible angry Julie was. She was angry that all the hard work and all the hope and all the dreams and all the trying and doing and loving didn't matter in the end, because you were sooner or later made dead forever. The scissors. If she knew about the light, she could stop being angry deep down. So Thomas TV'd that too, along with a warning and with three last words to her and to Bobby, words of his own, all three things at once, hoping they wouldn't get mixed up. The bad thing's coming. Look out, the bad thing. There's a light that loves you. The bad thing. I love you too. And there's a light. There's a light. The bad thing's coming. At 8:15, they were on the Foothill Freeway, rocketing toward the junction with the Ventura Freeway, which they would follow across the San Fernando Valley almost to the ocean before turning north toward Oxnard, Ventura, and eventually Santa Barbara. Julie knew she should slow down, but she couldn't. Speed relieved her tension a little. If she stayed even close to the 55-mile-an-hour limit, she was pretty sure that she would start to scream before they were past Burbank. A Benny Goodman tape was on the stereo. The exuberant melodies and syncopated rhythms seemed in time and sympathy with the headlong rush of the car. And if they'd been in a movie, Goodman's sounds would have been perfect background music to the tenebrous panorama of light-speckled night hills through which they passed from city to city, suburb to suburb. She knew why she was so tense. In a way she could never have anticipated, the dream was within their grasp. But they could lose everything as they reached for it, everything. Hope, each other, their lives. Sitting in the seat beside her, Bobby trusted her so implicitly that he could doze at more than 80 miles an hour, even though he knew that she, too, had slept only 3 hours last night. From time to time she glanced at him, just because it felt good to have him there. He did not yet understand why they were going north to check out the Pollard family, stretching their obligation to the client beyond reason. But his bafflement sprang from the fact that he was nearly as good a man as he appeared to be. He sometimes bent the rules and broke the laws on behalf of their clients, but he was more scrupulous in his personal life than anyone Julie had ever known. She'd been with him once when a newspaper vending machine gave him a copy of the Sunday Los Angeles Times, then malfunctioned and returned 3 of his 4 quarters to him, whereupon he repaid all 3 into the coin slot. Even though that same machine had malfunctioned to his disadvantage on other occasions over the years and was into him for a couple of bucks. "Yeah, well," he said, blushing, when she had laughed at his goody-goody deed, "maybe the machine can be crooked and live with itself, but I can't." Julie could have told him that they were hanging with the Pollard case because they saw a once-in-a-lifetime shot at really big bucks, the main chance for which every hustler in the world was looking and which most of them would never find. From the moment Frank had shown them all that cash in the flight bag and told them about the second cash back at the motel, they were locked in like rats in a maze, drawn forward by the smell of cheese, even though each of them had taken a turn at protesting any interest in the game. When Frank came back to that hospital room from God knows where with another $300,000, neither she nor Bobby even raised the issue of illegality, though it was by that time no longer possible to pretend that Frank was entirely innocent. By then, the smell of cheese was too strong to be resisted at all. They were plunging ahead because they saw the chance to use Frank to cash out of the rat race and buy into the dream sooner than they had expected. They were willing to use dirty money and questionable means to get their desired end, more willing than they could admit to each other, though Julie supposed it could be said in their favor that they were not yet so greedy they would simply steal the money and the diamonds from Frank and abandon him to the mercies of his psychotic brother. Or maybe even their sense of duty to their client was a lie now, a virtue they could point to later when they tried to justify to themselves their other less-than-noble acts and impulses. She could have told him all that, but she didn't, because she did not want to argue with him. She had to let him figure it out at his own pace, accept it in his own way. If she tried to tell him before he was able to understand it, he'd deny what she said. Even if he admitted to a fraction of the truth, he'd trot out an argument about the rightness of the dream, the basic morality of it, and use that to justify the means to the end. But she didn't think a noble end could remain purely noble if arrived at by immoral means. And though she could not turn away from this main chance, she worried that when they achieved the dream, it would be sullied, not what it might have been. Yet she drove on, fast, because speed relieved some of her fear and tension. It numbed caution, too, and without caution she was less likely to retreat from the dangerous confrontation with the Pollard family that seemed inevitable if they were going to seize the opportunity to obtain immense and liberating wealth. They were in a clearing in traffic, with nothing close behind them, and trailing the nearest forward car by about a quarter of a mile, when Bobby cried out and sat up in his seat as if warning her of some imminent collision. He jerked forward, pulling the shoulder harness taut, and put his hands on his head as though stricken by a sudden migraine. Frightened, she let up on the accelerator, lightly tapping the brake pedal, and said, "Bobby, what is it?" In a voice coarsened by fear and sharpened by urgency, speaking above the music of Benny Goodman, he said, "Bad thing! The bad thing! Look out! There's a light! There's a light that loves you!"
Kendi looked down at the bloody body at his feet and knew that he should not have killed Thomas. Instead, he should have taken him away to a private place and tortured the answers out of him, even if it took hours for the dummy to remember everything Kendi needed to know. It could even have been fun. But he was in a rage greater than any he had ever known, and he was less in control of himself than at any time in his life since the day he had found his mother's dead body. He wanted vengeance not only for his mother, but for himself, and for everyone in the world who ever deserved revenge and never got it. God had made him an instrument of revenge, and now Kendi longed desperately to fulfill his purpose as he had never fulfilled it before. He yearned not merely to tear open the throat and drink the blood of one sinner, but of a great multitude of sinners. If ever his rage was to be dissipated, he needed not only to drink blood, but to become drunk on it, bathe in it, wade through rivers of it, stand on land saturated with it. He wanted his mother to free him from all the rules that had restricted his rage before, wanted God to turn him loose. He heard sirens in the distance, and he knew that he must go soon. Hot pain throbbed in his shoulder, where the scissors had parted muscle and scraped bone. But he would deal with that when he traveled. In reconstituting himself, he could easily remake his flesh whole and healthy. Stalking through the debris that littered the floor, he looked for something that might give him a clue to the whereabouts of either the Julie or the Bobby of whom Thomas had spoken. They might know who Thomas had been and why he possessed a gift that not even Candy's blessed mother had been able to impart. He touched various objects and pieces of furniture, but all he could extract from them were images of Thomas and Derek and some of the aides and nurses who took care of them. Then he saw a scrapbook lying open on the floor beside the table on which he had butchered Derek. The open pages were full of all kinds of pictures that had been pasted in lines and peculiar patterns. He picked the book up and leafed through it, wondering what it was. And when he tried to see the face of the last person who had handled it, he was rewarded with someone other than a dummy or a nurse. A hard-looking man, not as tall as Candy, but almost as solid. The sirens were less than a mile away now, louder by the second. Candy let his right hand glide over the cover of the scrapbook, seeking. Sometimes he could sense only a little, sometimes a lot. This time, he had to be successful, or this room was going to be a dead end in his search for the meaning of the dummy's power. Seeking. He received a name, Clint. Clint had sat in Derek's chair sometime during the afternoon, paging through this odd collection of pictures. When he tried to see where Clint had gone after leaving this room, he saw a Chevy that Clint was driving on the freeway, then a place called Dakota and Dakota. Then the Chevy again on a freeway at night. and then a small house in a place called Placentia. The approaching sirens were very close now, probably coming up the driveway into the Cielo Vista parking lot. Candy threw the book down. He was ready to go. He had only one more thing to do before he teleported. When he had discovered that Thomas was a dummy, and when he had realized that Cielo Vista was a place full of them, he had been angered and offended by the home's existence. He held his two hands 2 feet apart, palm facing palm. Sky blue light glowed between them. He remembered how neighbors and other people had talked about his sisters, and also about him, when as a boy he had been kept out of school because of his problems. Violet and Verbena looked and acted mentally deficient, and they probably did not care if people called them retards. Ignorant people labeled him retarded, too, because they thought he was excused from school for being as learning disabled and strange as his sisters. Only Frank attended classes like a normal child. The light began to coalesce into a ball. As more power poured out of his hands and into the ball, it acquired a deeper shade of blue and seemed to take on substance, as if it were a solid object floating in the air. Candy had been bright, with no learning disabilities at all. His mother taught him to read, write, and do math. So he got angry when he overheard people say he was a deadhead. He had been excused from school for other reasons, of course, mainly because of the sex thing. When he got older and bigger, nobody called him retarded or made jokes about him, at least not within his hearing. The sapphire blue sphere looked almost as solid as a genuine sapphire, but as big as a basketball. It was nearly ready. Having been unjustly tagged with a retarded label, Candy had not grown up with sympathy for the genuinely disabled, but with an intense loathing for them that he hoped would make it clear to even ignorant people that he definitely was not and never had been one of them. To think such a thing of him, or of his sisters for that matter, was an insult to his sainted mother, who was incapable of bringing a moron into the world. He cut off the flow of power and took his hands away from the sphere. For a moment he stared at it, smiling, thinking about what it would do to this offensive place. Through the missing window and the partially shattered walls, the wail of the sirens became deafening, then suddenly subsided from a high-pitched shriek to a low growl that spiraled toward silence.
"Help's here, Thomas," he said, and laughed.
He put one hand against the sapphire sphere and gave it a shove. It shot across the room as if it were a ballistic missile fired from its silo. It smashed through the wall behind Derek's bed, leaving a ragged hole as big as anything a cannonball could have made, through the wall beyond that, and through every additional wall that stood before it, spewing flames as it went, setting fire to everything along its path. Candy heard people screaming and a hard explosion, as he did a fade-out on his way to the house in Placentia.
Bobby stood at the side of the freeway, holding onto the open car door, gasping for breath. He'd been sure he was going to throw up, but the urge had passed. "Are you all right?" Julie asked anxiously.
I think so."
Traffic shot past. Each vehicle was trailed by a wake of wind and a roar that gave Bobby the peculiar feeling that he and Julie and the Toyota were still moving, doing 85 with him holding on to the open door and her with a hand on his shoulder, magically keeping their balance and avoiding road burn as they dragged their feet along the pavement with nobody driving. The dream had seriously unsettled and disoriented him. "Not a dream, really," he told her. He continued to keep his head down, peering at bits of loose gravel on the paved shoulder of the highway, half expecting the return of the cramping nausea. "Not like the dream I had before about us and the jukebox and the ocean of acid, but about the bad thing again." "Yeah. You couldn't call it a dream, though, because it was just this burst of words inside my head. From where? I don't know." He dared to lift his head, and though a whirl of dizziness swept through him, the nausea did not return. He said, "Bad thing... Look out. There's a light that loves you.
I can't remember it all. It was so strong, so hard, like somebody shouting at me through a bullhorn that was pressed against my ear. Except that's not right either, because I really didn't hear the words. They were just there in my head. But they felt loud, if that makes any sense. And there weren't images, like in a dream. Instead, there were these feelings as strong as they were confused. Fear and joy, anger and forgiveness. And right at the end of it, this strange sense of peace that I can't describe. A Peterbilt thundered toward them, towing the biggest trailer the law allowed. Sweeping out of the night behind its blazing headlights, it looked like a leviathan swimming up from a deep marine trench, all raw power and cold rage, with a hunger that could never be satisfied. For some reason, as it boomed past them, Bobby thought of the man he had seen on the beach at Punalu, and he shuddered. Julie said, "Are you okay?"
"Yeah."
"Are you sure?" He nodded. "A little dizzy, that's all."
"What now?"
He looked at her. "What else? We go on to Santa Barbara, El Encanto Heights. Bring this thing to an end, somehow."
Kendi arrived in the archway between a living room and dining room. No one was in either place. He heard a buzzing sound farther back in the house, and after a moment he identified it as an electric razor. It stopped. Then he heard water running in a sink and the drone of a bathroom exhaust fan. He intended to head straight for the hall and the bath, take the man by surprise, but he heard a rustle of paper from the opposite direction. He crossed the dining room and stepped into the kitchen doorway. It was smaller than the kitchen in his mother's house, but it was as spotlessly clean and orderly as his mother's kitchen had not been since her death. A woman in a blue dress was sitting at the table, her back to him. She was leaning over a magazine, turning the pages one after the other, as if looking for something of interest to read. Kendi possessed a far greater control of his telekinetic talents than Frank enjoyed, and in particular could teleport more efficiently and swiftly than Frank, creating less air displacement and less noise from molecular resistance. Nevertheless, he was surprised that she had not gotten up to investigate, for the sounds he had made during arrival had been only one small room away from her, and surely odd enough to prick her curiosity. She turned a few more pages, then leaned forward to read. He could not see much of her from behind. Her hair was thick, lustrous, and so black it seemed to have been spun on the same loom as the night. Her shoulders and back were slender. Her legs, which were both to one side of the chair and crossed at the ankles, were shapely. If he had been a man with any interest in sex, he supposed he would have been excited by the curve of her calves. Wondering what she looked like, and suddenly overwhelmed by a need to know how her blood would taste, he stepped out of the open doorway and took three steps to her. He made no effort to be silent, but she did not look up. The first she became aware of him was when he seized a handful of her hair and dragged her, kicking and flailing, out of her chair. He turned her around and was instantly excited by her. He was indifferent to her shapely legs, the flare of her hips, the trimness of her waist, the fullness of her breasts. Though beautiful, it was not even her face that electrified him. Something else, a quality in her gray eyes. Call it vitality. She was more alive than most people, vibrant. She did not scream, but let out a low grunt of fear or anger, then struck him furiously with both fists. She pounded his chest, battered his face. Vitality, yes, this one was full of life, bursting with life, and her vitality thrilled him far more than any bounty of sexual charms. He could still hear the distant splash of water, the rattle hum of the bathroom exhaust fan, and he was confident that he could take her without drawing the attention of the man, as long as he could prevent her from screaming. He struck her on the side of the head with his fist, hammered her before she could scream. She slumped against him, not unconscious, but dazed. Shaking with the anticipation of pleasure, Kendi placed her on her back on the table with her legs trailing over the edge. He spread her legs and leaned between them, but not to commit rape, nothing as disgusting as that. As he lowered his face toward hers, she first blinked at him in confusion, still rattle-brained from the blows she had taken. Then her eyes began to clear. He saw horrified comprehension return to her, and he went quickly for her throat, bit deep, and found the blood, which was clean and sweet, intoxicating. She thrashed beneath him. She was so alive, so wonderfully alive, for a while.
When the delivery man brought the pizza, Lee Chen took it into Bobby and Julie's office and offered some to Hal. Putting his book aside, but not taking his stockinged feet off the coffee table, Hal said, "You know what that stuff does to your arteries? Why is everyone so concerned about my arteries today?" "Oh, you're such a nice young man. We'd hate to see you dead before you're 30. Besides, we'd always wonder what clothes you might have worn next if you'd lived." "Well, not anything like what you're wearing, I assure you." Hal leaned over and looked in the box that Lee held down to him. "Looks pretty good. Rule of thumb, any pizza they'll bring to you, they're selling service instead of good food. But this doesn't look bad at all. You can actually tell where the pizza ends and the cardboard begins." Lee tore the lid off the box, put it on the coffee table, and put two slices of pizza on the makeshift plate. "There. You're not going to give me half?" "Oh, what about your cholesterol?" "Hell, cholesterol's just a little animal fat. It isn't arsenic."
When the woman's strong heart stopped beating, Candy pulled back from her. Though blood still seeped from her ravaged throat, he did not touch another drop of it. The thought of drinking from a corpse sickened him. He remembered his sister's cats eating their own each time one of the pack died, and he grimaced. Even as he raised his wet lips from her throat, he heard a door open farther back in the house. Footsteps approached. Candy quickly circled the table, putting it and the dead woman between himself and the doorway to the dining room. From the vision induced by the dummy scrapbook of pictures, Candy knew that Clint would not be as easy to handle as most people were. He preferred to put a little distance between them, give himself time to size up his opponent rather than take the guy by surprise. Clint appeared in the doorway. Except for his outfit, gray slacks, navy blue blazer, maroon V-neck, white shirt, he looked the same as the psychic impression he had left on the book. He had pumped a lot of iron in his time. His hair was thick, black, combed straight back from his forehead. He had a face like carved granite and a hard look in his eyes. Excited by the recent kill, by the taste of blood still in his mouth, Candy watched the man with interest, wondering what would happen next. There were all sorts of ways it could go, and not one of them would be dull. Clint did not react as Candy expected. He did not show surprise when he saw the woman sprawled dead upon the table. He did not seem horrified, shattered by the loss of her, or outraged. Something major changed in his stony face, though below the surface, like tectonic plates shifting under the mantle of the earth's crust. Finally, he met Candy's gaze and said, "You." The note of recognition in that single word was unsettling. For a moment, Candy could think of no way this man could know him. Then he remembered Thomas. The possibility that Thomas had told this man, and perhaps others, about Candy, was the most frightening turn in Candy's life since his mother's death. His service in God's army of avengers was a deeply private matter, a secret that should not have been spread beyond the Pollard family. His mother had warned him that it was all right to be proud of doing God's work, but that his pride would lead him to a fall if he boasted of his divine favor to others. "Satan," she had told him, "constantly seeks the names of lieutenants in God's army, which is what you are, and when he finds them, he destroys them with worms that eat them alive from within, worms fat as snakes, and he rains fire on them, too. If you can't keep the secret, you'll die and go to hell for your big mouth." "Candy," Clint said. The use of his name erased whatever doubt remained that the secret had been passed outside the family, and that Candy was in deep trouble, though he had not broken the code of silence himself. He imagined that even now Satan, in some dark and steaming place, had tilted his head and said, "Who? Who did you say? What was his name? Candy? Candy who?" As furious as he was frightened, Candy started around the kitchen table, wondering if Clint had learned about him from Thomas. He was determined to break the man, make him talk, before killing him. In a move as unexpected as his rock-calm acceptance of the woman's murder, Clint reached inside his jacket, withdrew a revolver, and fired 2 shots. He might have fired more than 2, but those were the only ones Candy heard. The first round hit him in the stomach, the second in the chest, pitching him backward. Fortunately, he sustained no damage to head or heart. If his brain tissue had been scrambled, disturbing the mysterious and fragile connection between brain and mind, leaving his mind trapped within his ruined brain before he had a chance to separate the two, he would not have possessed the mental ability to teleport, leaving him vulnerable to a coup de grace. And if his heart had been stopped instantaneously by a well-placed bullet before he could dematerialize, he would have fallen down dead where he'd stood. Those were the only wounds that might finish him. He was many things, but he was not immortal. So he was grateful to God for letting him get out of that kitchen and back to his mother's house alive.
The Ventura Freeway. Julie drove fast, though not as fast as she had earlier. On the tape deck, Artie Shaw's Nightmare. Bobby brooded, staring through the side window at the nightscape. He could not stop thinking about the blare of words that had seared through him, loud as a bomb blast and bright as a blast furnace fire. He'd come to terms with the dream that had frightened him last week. Everyone had bad dreams. Though exceptionally vivid, almost more real than real life, there had been nothing uncanny about it, or so he had convinced himself, but this was different. He could not believe that these urgent, lava-hot words had erupted from his own subconscious. A dream, with complex Freudian messages couched in elaborate scenes and symbols. Yes, that was understandable. After all, the subconscious dealt in euphemisms and metaphors. But this word burst had been blunt, direct, like a telegraph delivered on a wire plugged directly into his cerebral cortex. When he wasn't brooding, Bobby was fidgeting because of Thomas. For some reason, the longer he dwelt on the blaze of words, the more Thomas slipped into his thoughts. He could see no connection between the two, so he tried to put Thomas out of his mind and concentrate on turning up an explanation for the experience. But Thomas gently, insistently returned again and again. After a while, Bobby got the uneasy feeling there was a link between the word burst and Thomas, though he had no ghost of an idea what it might be. Worse, as the miles rolled up on the odometer and they reached the western end of the valley, Bobby began to sense that Thomas was in danger. And because of me and Julie, Bobby thought. Danger? From whom? From what? The biggest danger that Bobby and Julie faced right now was Candy Pollard. But even that jeopardy lay in the future, for Candy didn't know about them yet. He was not aware that they were working on Frank's behalf, and he might never become aware of it, depending upon how things went in Santa Barbara and El Encanto Heights. Yes, he had seen Bobby on the beach at Punalu with Frank, but he had no way of knowing who Bobby was. Ultimately, even if Candy became aware of Dakota and Dakota's association with Frank, there was no way that Thomas could be drawn into the affair. Thomas was another separate part of their lives, right? Something wrong? Julie said as she pulled the Toyota one lane to the left to pass a big rig hauling Coors. He could see nothing to be gained by telling her that Thomas might be in danger. She'd be upset, worried. And for what? He was just letting his vivid imagination run away with him. Thomas was perfectly safe down there in Cielo Vista. Bobby, what's wrong? Nothing. Well, why are you fidgeting? Prostate trouble.
Chanel number 5, a softly glowing lamp, cozy rose-patterned fabrics and wallpaper. He laughed with relief when he materialized in the bedroom, the bullets left behind in that kitchen in Placentia over 100 miles away. His wounds had knit up as if they'd never existed. He had lost perhaps an ounce of blood and a few flecks of tissue because one of the bullets had passed through him and out his back, carrying that material with it before he'd transported himself beyond the revolver's range. Everything else was as it should be, however, and his flesh did not harbor even the memory of pain. He stood in front of the dresser for half a minute, breathing deeply of the perfume that wafted up from the saturated handkerchief. The scent gave him courage and reminded him of the abiding need to make them pay for his mother's murder. All of them, not just Frank, but the whole world which had conspired against her. He looked at his face in the mirror. The gray-eyed woman's blood was no longer on his chin and lips. He had left it behind him, as he might leave water behind when teleporting out of a rainstorm. But the taste of it was still in his mouth, and his reflection was, without a doubt, that of vengeance personified. Depending on the element of surprise and his ability to target his point of arrival precisely, now that he was familiar with the kitchen, he returned to Clint's house. He intended to enter at the dining room doorway, immediately behind the man, directly opposite the point from which he had dematerialized. Either the experience of being shot had shaken him more than he realized, or the rage jittering through him had passed the critical point at which it interfered with his concentration. Whatever the reason, he did not arrive where he intended, but by the door to the garage, one quarter instead of halfway around the room from his last position, to the right of Clint, and not near enough to rush him and seize the gun before it could be fired. Except Clint was not present, and the woman's body had been removed from the table. Only the blood remained as proof that she perished there. Kendi could not have been gone more than a minute, the time he had spent in his mother's room, plus a couple of seconds in transit each way. He expected to return and find Clint bent over the corpse, either grieving or checking desperately for a pulse. But as soon as he realized Kendi was gone, the man must have taken the body in his arms and what? He must have fled the house, of course, hoping against hope that a faint thread of life remained unbroken in the woman, getting her out of the way in case Kendi returned. Cursing softly, then immediately begging his mother's and God's forgiveness for his foul language, Kendi tried the door into the garage. It was locked. If he had left by that exit, Clint wouldn't have paused to lock behind himself. He hurried out of the kitchen through the dining room toward the foyer off the living room to check out the front lawn and the street. But he heard a noise from deeper in the house and halted before he reached the front door. He changed direction, cautiously following the hallway back to the bedrooms. A light was on in one of those rooms. He eased to the door and risked a glance inside. Clint had just put the woman on the queen-size bed. As Kendi watched, the man pulled her skirt down over her knees. He still had the revolver in one hand. For the second time in less than an hour, Kendi heard faraway sirens swelling in the night. The neighbors probably had heard the gunfire and called the police. Clint saw him in the doorway, but did not bring up the gun. He did not say anything either, and the expression on his stoic face remained unchanged. He seemed like a deaf mute. The strangeness of the man's demeanor made Kendi nervous and uncertain. He thought there was a pretty good chance that Clint had emptied the gun at him in the kitchen, even though he had teleported out of there with the impact of the second slug. Most likely he had fired every round reflexively, his trigger finger ruled by rage or fear or whatever he was feeling. He could not have carried the woman into the bedroom and reloaded the gun, too, in the minute or so that Kendi had been gone, which meant Kendi might be in no danger if he just walked up to the guy and took the weapon away from him. But he stayed in the doorway. Either of those two shots could have been dead center in his heart. The power within him was great, but he could not exercise it quickly enough to vaporize an oncoming bullet. Instead of dealing with Kendi in any fashion, the man turned away from him, walked around the foot of the bed to the other side, and stretched out beside the woman.
"What the hell?"
Kendi said aloud. Clint took hold of her dead hand. His other hand held the .38 revolver. He turned his head on the pillow to look toward her, and his eyes glistened with what might have been unshed tears. He put the muzzle of the gun under his chin and annihilated himself. Kendi was so stunned that he was unable to move for a moment or think what to do next. He was jolted out of his paralysis by the ululant sirens and realized that the trail from Thomas to Bobby and Julie, whoever they were, might end here if he did not discover what link the dead man on the bed shared with them. If he ever hoped to learn who Thomas had been, how Clint had known his name, or how many others knew of him, if he wanted to learn how much danger he was in and how he might slide out of it, he couldn't waste this opportunity. He hurried to the bed, rolled the dead man onto his side, and withdrew the wallet from his pants pocket. He flipped it open and saw the private investigator's license. Opposite it, in another plastic window, was a business card for Dakota and Dakota. Kendi remembered a vague image of the Dakota and Dakota offices which had come to him in Thomas's room when he had obtained a vision of Clint from the scrapbook. There was an address on the card. Below the name Clint Karagiosis, in smaller type, were the names Robert and Julia Dakota. Outside, the sirens had died. Someone was pounding on the front door. Two voices shouted, "Police!" Kendi threw the wallet aside and took the gun out of the dead man's hand. He broke open the cylinder. It was a five-shot weapon, and all of the chambers were filled with expended cartridges. Clint had fired four rounds in the kitchen, but even in his moment of vengeful fury, he had possessed enough control to save the last bullet for himself.
"Just because of a woman?"
Kendi said uncomprehendingly, as if the dead man might answer him.
"Because you couldn't get sex from her any more now? Why does sex matter so much? Couldn't you get sex from another woman? Why was sex with this one so important you didn't want to live without it?"
They were still pounding on the door. Someone spoke through a bullhorn, but Kendi didn't pay attention to what was being said. He dropped the gun and wiped his hand on his pants because he suddenly felt unclean. The dead man had handled the gun, and the dead man seemed to have been obsessed with sex. Without question, the world was a cesspool of lust and debauchery, and Kendi was glad that God and his mother had spared him from the sick desires that seemed to infect nearly everyone else. He left that house of sinners.
Slumped on the sofa, Hal Yamataka had a slice of pizza in one hand and a McDonald novel in the other. When he heard the hollow, flute-like warble, he dropped both the book and the food and shot to his feet. "Frank?" The half-open door swung slowly inward, not because it was being pushed open by anyone, but because a sudden draft sweeping in from the reception lounge was strong enough to move it. "Frank?" Hal repeated. As he crossed the room, the sound faded and the draft died. But by the time he reached the doorway, the unmelodic notes returned and a burst of wind ruffled his hair. To the left stood the receptionist's desk, untended at this hour. Directly opposite the desk was the door to the public corridor that served the other companies on this level, and it was closed. The only other door at the far end of the rectangular lounge was also closed. It led to a hallway that was interior to the Dakota and Dakota suite, off which were six other offices, including the computer room where Lee was still at work, and a bathroom. The piping and the wind could not have reached him through those closed doors. Therefore, the point of origin was clearly the reception lounge. Stepping to the center of the room, he looked around expectantly. The flute sounds, the turbulence rose a third time. Hal said, "Frank," as he became aware, out of the corner of his eye, that a man had arrived near the door to the public hall, to Hal's right, and almost behind him. But when he turned, he saw that it was not Frank. The traveler was a stranger. But Hal knew him at once. Kendi. It could be no one else, for this was the man Bobby had described from the beach at Punaluu, and whose description Hal had received from Clint. Hal was built low and wide. He kept in good shape, and he could remember no instance in his life when he had been physically intimidated by another man. Candy was 8 inches taller than he, but Hal had handled men taller than that. Candy was clearly a mesomorph, one of those guys destined from birth to have a strong boned body layered with slabs of muscle, even if he exercised lightly or not at all. And he was clearly no stranger to the discipline and painful rituals of barbells, dumbbells, and slant boards. But Hal had a mesomorphic body type as well, and was as hard as frozen beef. He was not intimidated by Candy's height or muscles. What frightened him was the aura of insanity, rage, and violence the man radiated as powerfully as a week-old corpse would radiate the stink of death. The instant that Frank's brother hit the room, Hal smelled his mad ferocity as surely as a healthy dog would detect the rabid odor of a sick one, and he acted accordingly. He wasn't wearing shoes, wasn't carrying a gun, and wasn't aware of anything near at hand that might be used as a weapon, so he spun around and ran back toward the boss's office, where he knew a loaded Browning 9mm semi-automatic pistol was kept in a spring clip on the underside of Julie's desk as insurance against the unexpected. Until now, the gun had never been needed. Hal was not the martial arts whiz that his formidable appearance and ethnicity led everyone to believe he was, but he did know some taekwondo. The problem was, only a fool would resort to any form of martial arts as a first defense against a charging bull with a bumblebee up his butt. He made the doorway before Candy grabbed him by his shirt and tried to pull him off his feet. The shirt tore along the seams, leaving the madman with a handful of cloth. But Hal was wrenched off balance. He stumbled into the office and collided with Julie's big chair, which was still standing in the middle of the room with four other chairs arranged in a semicircle in front of it, as Jackie Jacks had required for Frank's session of hypnosis. He grabbed at Julie's chair for support. It was on wheels, which rolled grudgingly on the carpet, though well enough to send it skidding treacherously out from under him. The psycho crashed into him, ramming him against the chair and the chair against the desk. Leaning into Hal with massive fists that felt like iron heads of sledgehammers, Candy delivered a flurry of punches to his midsection. Hal's hands were down, leaving him briefly defenseless, but he clasped them with his thumbs aligned and rammed them upward between Candy's pile-driving arms, catching him in the Adam's apple. The blow was hard enough to make Candy gag on his own cry of pain, and Hal's thumbnails gouged the madman's flesh, skidding all the way up under his chin, tearing the skin as they went. Choking, unable to draw breath through his bruised and spasming esophagus, Candy staggered backward, both hands to his throat. Hal pushed away from the chair against which he had been pinned, but he didn't go after Candy. Even the blow he'd delivered was the equivalent of a tap of a fly swatter to the snout of that bull with a bee up his butt. An overconfident charge would no doubt end in a swift goring. Instead, hurting from the punches to his gut, with a sour taste of pizza sauce in the back of his throat, he hurried around the desk, hot to get his hands on that 9mm Browning. The desk was large, and the dimensions of the knee hole were correspondingly spacious. He wasn't sure where the pistol was clipped, and he didn't want to bend down to look under, because he would have had to take his eyes off Candy. He slid his hand from left to right along the underside of the desktop, then reached deeper and slid it back the other way. Just as he touched the butt of the pistol, he saw Candy thrust out both hands, palms upward, as if the guy knew Hal had found a gun and was saying, "Don't shoot, I surrender, stop." But as Hal tugged the Browning free from the metal spring clamp, he discovered that Candy didn't have surrender in mind. Blue light flashed out of the madman's palms. The heavy desk abruptly behaved like a wire-rigged balsa wood prop in a movie about poltergeists. Even as Hal was raising the gun, the desk slammed into him and carried him backward into the huge